Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Landides, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us for today's show. On the episode today, we've got Rob Hyder, formerly of EA. He is coming on to talk about the EA Sports MMA video game. Rob was the game director and essentially the project leader on it. So he's got all kinds of stories talking about dealing with Fedor, talking about dealing with Kung Lee, talking about dealing with Jason Mayhem Miller. So much stuff into this episode. We talk about especially EA dealing with Dana White. A lot of heat between Dana and EA because Dana wanted EA to pick up the UFC video game and they didn't at that time. Lots of stuff that we delve into with that, how Strikeforce became involved, and so much more. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right, on the line with us, we have Rob Hyder. Rob, I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction for you, but this is, you know, a bit of a unique interview for the podcast. I've pretty much only spoken with fighters, people that have been punched in the head a lot, or a promoter who people have wanted to punch in the head. But this time we've got a guest who's been, you know, wasn't involved from that side of the industry, but for a time was very involved in the MMA industry. So Rob, you were a producer and a senior producer at EA for 15 years. During that time, you were the game director and project leader for EA Sports MMA. And that's what we're going to discuss today. So Rob, thank you for joining me.
Great. Happy to be here. Yeah. Looking forward to reminiscing a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about, I'm going to do a little bit of a build up, but I want to talk about the idea of how the game came to fruition. But before we get into that, let's delve a bit into the history of MMA video games. And you may already know some of this, Rob, and or I may be educating you, but the first UFC video game called Ultimate Fighting Championship, they really put a lot of thought into the naming convention there, but it was released in 2000 with Tito Ortiz on the cover. I remember playing that game. I actually enjoyed it. There were a couple other games that were released over the next few years. There was 2002's UFC Throwdown, and then there was a gap of about 7 years until UFC 2009 Undisputed, which was done in conjunction with THQ. So this brings us to EA Sports MMA. The game was announced in June of 2009. But from your recollection, Rob, what made EA want to get into the MMA business, and especially without the UFC, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, but do you remember kind of what made the company want to get into that?
Sure. Yeah. So EA Sports does pretty well for itself, right? And they're always looking for what is the next thing, right? We've got Madden, we've got FIFA, we got NBA Live at the time was doing really well. And, you know, 2005, Forrest Griffin, Stefan Bonner, MMA comes onto the map, and I think it started tracking. So the thing you have to know is the CEO of EA rolls. So he's a jiu-jitsu fighter. Okay. Yeah. And he rolls with Gracies. So, you know, it's a non-trivial thing. And so he's always been a fight guy. And so, yeah, I think once UFC sort of got on the radar as a legit organization, there was always sort of a half eye towards it. And then somewhere around 2007, 2008, it was sort of, let's see what we can do here. So in 2008, the project started to come together, green light process and all that good stuff. So that's when it really started to get serious.
Okay. So as part of that, apparently that this is, Dana White is known for being, which by the way, did you ever meet Dana or have any conversations with him?
I never met him directly. We certainly had indirect conversations back and forth between him and EA. That was fun.
Okay. So as part of that, there was, there's these things that were said that eventually in the media, but basically Dana's point of view was that he wanted EA to pick up the rights to UFC's game franchise, but the company declined. And he said, in his words, that EA basically told him that MMA was not a legit sport and that they essentially didn't want anything to do with it. So instead, again, they end up partnering with THQ and they developed UFC 2009 Undisputed. Eventually, EA and the UFC did partner up, but that wasn't for a few years. Is that how you remember it? Is that just Dana bluster from Dana White? What was the situation with the UFC there?
So I wasn't involved in the conversation. There was a conversation. There's no doubt about that. I believe there's a bit of embellishment on Dana's part. Just a wee bit, but you know, but I think at the time the UFC wasn't sort of as, we knew they were big, right? We knew that they were becoming really big in the sport. But we also knew that, it wasn't necessarily an organization that we wanted to, work closely with initially. I think looking back on it, it was probably a mistake if you could see the trajectory that they were on. But you know, between 2005 and 2008, they had some growing to do. So I can absolutely see somebody going in there at the, say, vice president level and having a conversation and then coming out of it going, yeah, I don't know about this guy. And then him cranking up the volume based on his being upset with how things went.
Right. Which, I mean, from an optic standpoint, you look at the UFC today and obviously it's this massive, massive, you know, juggernaut, this media powerhouse, and everything is, you know, the graphics to the, you know, the presentation, everything is top of the line. But back in those days, back in the 2000, I mean, they were in trouble before those, the 2000, the Ultimate Fighter was a real gamble that really saved them. And they had started by 2008, they started pulling in, you know, $1 million gates at their events and stuff like that. But they were still, they weren't on Fox yet. They weren't on any network. In fact, they were beaten to the networks by Elite XC and then even by Strikeforce. So they weren't, and there's a lot of thought that Dana's, you know, his presentation, who he is, his mouth, his, you know, everything about him, like you said, the VP coming out of a meeting with Dana going, I don't know about this guy. He's, you know, Vince McMahon with, you know, more cuss words, less hair, basically. So right. there's just, yeah, I could totally see that. And then you meet with Scott Coker and it's a much different presentation. You know, he's more soft-spoken, more agreeable, you know, all of that. But all right, well, let's jump back to it. So after it was announced, EA began to release images and videos in order to promote the game. The first official trailer was released at Strikeforce Fedor versus Rogers, which was in the fall of 2009, showed the two main eventers, Fedor, Emelianenko and Brett Rogers, pounding on each other. We recently covered that event on this show, and I thought that was such a cool feature. Like, I thought that was a really cool marketing idea. I don't know if it was from EA's side or Strikeforce side. I would assume EA's side. But I thought that was really, really a cool idea to, you know, okay, well, this is how we see this playing out. You start to see Randy Couture and Fedor, who were the quote-unquote cover boys, they would battle each. Everybody wanted to see that fight at that point, but the only way we ever got to see it was in the video game, but them actually playing each other. I remember that from that time, seeing footage of them playing the game against each other and that sort of thing. And so that was cool. Lots of, you know, real promotional stuff. More footage shown at 2010's E3 video game conference, which also hosted Strikeforce Los Angeles, a fight card with some decent bouts on it. So obviously, Strikeforce is named the flagship promotion for the show. So how did y'all pivot from UFC? You started, you know, we're going to do our own game, and then Strikeforce is going to be the leader. How did that partnership come about?
Yeah, so that is the question. That's a great question, and I'm going to give you some of it, but I'm like, there's holes in my memory, so my apologies.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were a handful of people that were sort of friends and family of the game team, and they were absolutely instrumental in helping us get plugged into the MMA community. Obviously, one of those is Scott Coker. I mean, he knows everybody, and once we connected with him, you know, lots and lots of doors opened. I'll mention a couple others, but, and then I'll get back to Scott. Frank Shamrock was a big friend of the team. Big John McCarthy was a big friend of the team. Boss Rutan over time became a big friend of the team. It was quite
all
entertaining.
All great guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And people who had connections, who could make introductions to other people, because all of the stuff that we did had to be started from, you know, sort of clean sheet. Like, we had to go meet people that we didn't know yet. So they were all instrumental. But Scott was probably the most instrumental. So my executive producer, Dale Jackson, was the person who made the first connection to Scott. And I'll be honest, I don't know who made that first introduction. It may have been somebody within EA, within the marketing team. So we have guys who just, There's literally a guy at EA, I don't think he's there anymore, who is just friends with celebrities. And you would go to him if you needed a name or an introduction.
Okay.
He mostly worked with us on football. I worked at the studio that it's the house that Madden built, Tiburon, in Orlando. But he knew lots and lots of folks in the world of sports. So the horrible part is I can't tell you who made that first introduction, but I can tell you once that first introduction was made, we hit it off really well with Scott. I believe we went out to one of the Strike Force events in St. Louis,
Okay.
and that's where we saw and met Fedor for the first time. But that was sort of, I think, first face to face with him from a relationship point of view. But we were on the phone and talking with him fairly constantly after that point,
Okay.
after we'd first met.
Okay. All right, so this actually isn't in my notes, but I am curious. We're going to get into some of the fighters that were in it. So let me shelve that and then I'll ask it. But
Okay.
as you were the game director and project leader, so for the uninitiated, I don't have time to play video games anymore thanks to my kids, but
Sure.
I'm one of those ones. I would generally get one game like a NBA 2K and just play that through from rookie to Hall of Fame, and that's the only game that I will play during that time. I am not like the traditional gamer now of I'm just not. So game director and project leader, what exactly does that mean to the uninitiated?
Sure. Yeah, good question. From a practical purpose, it means that everybody who's working on the game reports in under me. So all the artists at the time, all the artists, all the engineers, all the designers, everybody who was assigned to the game team reported up through me, and I reported to an executive producer. The executive producer is the executive level sponsor for a game. They have the very high level P&L responsibility. I had a certain level of profit and loss responsibility, but he's the one who's coordinating with senior EA management, with marketing, with a lot of the finance organization, etc. So my job is to get the game built and get it built with a high level of quality, and his job is to make sure that we are running this as a business and that we're set up to make money given all of the resources that we're putting into the effort.
Okay, cool. All right, I appreciate that breakdown. That helps. All right, so let's talk about some of the fighters. So this is a very, very truncated list of fighters that were in the game. I mean, it was a huge list, but we already mentioned Randy Couture. We already mentioned Fedor, Kung Lee, and then a bunch of Strike Force fighters, and then even outside of that, Shinya Aoki, former UFC heavyweight champions Tim Sylvia, who was never part of Strike Force, Andrei Arlovsky, who was. Frank Trigg, who had a one-off with Strike. I mean, there's just tons of big names and many, many more. So the question I was going to ask earlier was, and I assume the answer is yes, but all these fighters they owned their own likeness. They were all individually signed, I imagine, versus UFC owns the likeness. And you may or may not be aware of this, but several years ago, John Fitch had a huge fight with them over not wanting to turn over his likeness. It's a big deal. It really, really is a big deal. But so the UFC, you do a deal with them, and they own the likeness, so they decide who gets, to go in the game. They decide whether or not any sort of payment or income goes to those fighters. This was different. These fighters own their own likeness. Strikeforce didn't own them, so you were able to pick up guys outside of Strikeforce along with fighters that are inside. So it was a long question of basically, is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, and
Oh,
it's a two
easy. Okay.
yeah. So it's a two-edged sword, right? As you said, you get the UFC license, you get a bunch of fighters, you don't have to go do a lot of work. It's a lot like, you sign the NFL Players Association, you get all the players. You don't have to go sign everybody individually. Having said that, yeah, we had to go sign everybody individually, and I think Dale took Randy Couture and Fedor and perhaps one more. And he did the signings on those because those were big and those were expensive. And I signed everybody else,
Okay.
which was fun. The only caveat to this is the Japanese fighters came as a package. So we negotiated with their rights group in Japan. And there's a bit of an interesting story there. And then it's interesting that you mentioned Fitch, because if I remember correctly, that happened right in the middle of our development, and there was a window where he was unsigned by the UFC, and we reached out and said hello. And I think it was only like 2 or 3 weeks while they were upset with each other. And we, you know, if we could have grabbed him, we would have had his rights, and then he can go back to the UFC and be fine, just like Randy did. Randy right. had one more fight with the UFC after we had signed him. We were agile. You think of EA sometimes as this big sort of monolithic company, but game teams operate independently, and we were very much watching everything going on in the fight game. And if we saw somebody come available that we really wanted, we went after them. And quite frankly, so it's the NBA draft today. We had our draft list. We had a board where we tracked everybody that we wanted. And so there would be exciting days where we'd get somebody at near the top of our board, and it was like, yeah, this person's going to be awesome. So,
right. Okay. Yeah. So I dealt with you a little bit and Randy Chase little bit as well. I was managing Lyle Fancy Pants Beerbaum at this time.
Yep.
And I was trying to chase down sponsors because essentially you all were allowing sponsors to be like on the fight shorts, just as it was back then. So, you know, different companies would pay to be able to do that. So it was a very different process than I assumed that it would be with the UFC. And then, like you said, trying to go to all these different guys and come up with numbers. So I'm not asking you to tell me how much you paid any of them, but can you give us kind of like a ballpark of maybe what the lower level guys were getting, you know, to what the mid level guys, to the guys at the tippy top, kind of a ballpark of what they were getting?
Well, it is 10 years later and I don't work for EA, so I don't feel terribly uncomfortable. On the other hand, I don't want to expose everybody to what everybody was making back then.
I'm not asking you to name anybody. Just a ballpark so we can kind of get an idea.
So bottom level, you know, everybody was getting, well, so the minimum is in the four figures, right? And you know, if you were one of our sort of, this guy's good, but he's not awesome, you know, you're probably looking mid four figures. Five figures were significant, and I can tell you our cover athletes, and we had a separate cover athlete for Japan, so we had, and I'm going to have to look up his last name.
Hideki Yoshida.
Yes.
Hideki Yoshida. Yep.
Two-time Olympic judo gold medalist, and there's a story behind how we got him. It's an interesting story. Well, so he was not in the original set of four fighters that we signed. Shinya Aoki was, and that's the one we really wanted. Yeah. But one of the fighters that we signed with in the Japanese group backed out on us and said he didn't want to do it. And that brought enough disgrace, shame, whatever, so that we were approached by their management and they said, we're very sorry. This person is not going to be involved with this. Can we make it up to you and give you this fighter instead? And you know, we went and read his bio and we began to realize who we were talking about and what was going on there.
Big deal in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
In Japan. Yeah, big star for Pride. Yeah.
So I have actually pictures on my Facebook site of me and Shinya Aoki and me and Hidehiko, sorry, at our announcement in Japan. And I think Hidehiko has got me in a throw and I think I'm going like, I'm in a suit and I'm going, you know, fists up with Shinya Aoki, which is just ridiculous.
That's really cool.
But they were both there for us when we announced that we were doing a Japanese version of the game. They were really nice to work with as far as marketing was concerned. And yeah, we put them on the cover and then there's more to the story in terms of we didn't sell that well in Japan because you sort of have, it's sort of who you know over there. You have to get into retail in a certain way. But from a fighter point of view, they could not have been better to work with.
Okay. Very cool. I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. I again, not in my notes, but I watched Pride religiously and Yoshida was an awesome guy to watch. He usually lost because he just had the judo thing.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, he was always in big profile fights, so which was cool. But okay. The game also featured Mauro Ranallo and Frank Shamrock on commentary. I have worked with both these guys. Frank's actually been on this podcast twice. I love Frank. He's such a great guy.
Yes.
But what was that process like from the commentary standpoint?
Well, so one of the things you had to understand is that UFC Undisputed, the first in 2009, A sold, you know, 3.5 million copies, and B, we boiled it down to the fact that they did two things ridiculously well. One is when you hit somebody in the face, it looked really good. I mean, it was just like, damn, that looks good. It felt very satisfactory. But their sound, their announcers in that game were so much better than anything going on. It really felt like you were watching a pay-per-view. They did. I met their sound director at a game conference, and he did a hell of a job with that. My apologies. He did a heck of a
Oh no,
job with that game.
that's all right.
But you know, they really nailed it. And so we realized as soon as that thing came out that we had to go after a voice that was authentic to the game. You know, we couldn't use sort of actors or voice actors. And so we started looking around at who was out there. You know, we reached out to the lady who does the Japanese introductions.
Oh man, I can't. Lenny is her
Yes.
first name that does the
Yes.
screams. Oh my God, she's such. Oh, she's so awesome. She's so
And
awesome. Yeah.
she is such a professional to work with. So she was in Japan and she taped for us online. And I had for a while on an old phone, I had a ringtone of her saying my name that I
Oh,
wish I could have back. I really do.
God, that'd be awesome.
But you know, looking for who we should have as our announcer and color commentators. I mean, that was a bit of a process there, and we looked at a bunch of folks. And Moro, I mean, he was as good as anybody who was out there. You know, he had as much name recognition as anybody who wasn't doing the UFC. And he was good to work with. And as I said, Frank Shamrock was a friend of the family for all intents and purposes. So, you know, it became a no-brainer for us to use those two.
On a side note, because if I remember correctly, EA, you mentioned Orlando, but isn't EA headquartered kind of near the Bay Area, like Emory or something like that? Or am I okay?
Redwood
So I'm
Shores.
wondering, Redwood Shores. Okay, so yeah, I'm curious. Like, did that play into it, being that Strikeforce was based in San Jose? Like, did that factor in at all, or was it just that just happened to be happenstance?
So I'm going to speculate here. So Andrew Wilson is the CEO, right? And Andrew is the guy who rolls with Gracie's. And he had been the former executive producer on FIFA, so he's plugged into a lot of sports stuff. And it may well have been that he made that initial introduction to Dale Jackson for the Strike Force introduction, simply because they move in the same circles. I'm not 100% certain of that, but I can't believe that Andrew Wilson wasn't involved in some way.
I mean, it would make sense from a whatever you call. I don't. What's the thing where you the like the athletes put on like the black suits with the little balls on them and all that? Like, what is
Oh,
that,
mocap?
modeling? Yeah. Like,
Motion
because
capture?
I believe you guys did motion capture for this game, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I would think it would make a lot of Strikeforce fighters were Bay Area based. So I would think it would make it easier from a travel standpoint to get guys in as well, you know?
Well, so it's interesting, because we did two sets of mocap. We did some real fighters, and then we did some stuntmen. And real fighters do not want to go all out when you have them in mocap suits.
Really?
They don't want to get hurt. I
Oh,
mean,
yeah, that's kind of important. Yeah.
it's not a stupid thing on their part. But I think so. We do motion capture actually in a big studio up in Burnaby, outside of Vancouver, in British Columbia.
Oh, okay. So you don't
And
do the mocap in the Bay Area or in
no,
okay.
so so okay. So first off, we met with every single fighter, and we did do facial capture with every single fighter to get them into the game and make them look right. So we would do multiple, it's not a full body scan because we didn't have that technology then, but we take pictures like all the way around and from several different angles for lighting. And so we had to talk to basically every fighter that we put into the game face to face at some point. But motion capture, there was a fighter by the name of, I think it was Tim Kang, who was a BC based MMA fighter at the time. We brought him in, and we brought a couple of other guys in. Nobody
Could
with.
it be Dennis Kang by chance?
It might be. Yes, I'm
Okay,
sorry.
he's a well-known fighter. I don't
Yeah,
know who Tim Kang is, but
you're
Dennis
right.
Kang's one of them, and I'm pretty sure he's up there.
Yeah.
So,
So keep me honest.
okay.
Yeah, I think Tim Kang actually works where I work now. So never mind.
Okay. Shout out to Tim Kang.
There we go. So we brought Dennis in, and he was fine. But we, you know, what we want is the feel of power behind the punches and kicks and so forth. And you know, he was going about 70%. And you can see it not just in the videotape that we throw, but when we start looking at the motion capture, it just does, it's not as alive as you want it to be. So what we did is we opened auditions to stuntmen who had fighting backgrounds. We got some amazing people to come in. And stuntmen know that they get paid for risking their bodies, and they do
Right.
an amazing job of doing stuff. So what we don't need to do is knock out Fedor Emelianenko in this in a mocap session, because none of these guys was were going to do that. But what we do want is somebody who's willing to, well, go all out and do the flying arm bar, or kick over and over and over again until we get the right kick, down. Because a lot of it is repetition. That's the way that goes. But it was fun working. And I think we brought Jacare in
Okay.
and did some mocap with him. But once again, that was more for like it's B-roll for marketing. I'm not sure if his stuff got into the game, but it is also instructional for us to see him doing some of that stuff, because my goodness, he is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And it was good to have his things, especially if he had a signature move. Let's see what we can do about getting that into the game.
Okay, cool. That's good insight. I appreciate that. Well, I want to shift it back to Dana. We've got just a couple questions left. Again, really appreciate your time. But White, also apparently told fighters that if they did business with EA, that they would not be in the UFC. Despite that, again, we did see a bunch of former UFC fighters sign on for the game. And then Randy, like you said, was currently a UFC fighter at that time, but smartly, he had not agreed to turn his likeness over, so he was able to do this other game. And then, like you said, he ended up going back for one more fight with the UFC. So, what do you remember about heat from Dana? Did that factor into you guys at all? Was that just like an annoying mosquito that you swatted away, or was this a big deal to you guys at that time?
No, it was a big deal. First off, anytime Dana would go on and mention us, we were very happy.
Of course, free publicity.
He was some of our best advertisement, and we really appreciated that, and we celebrated every time he did it. He also, though, reached out to his friends. So American Top Team, even guys who weren't fighting in the UFC, were staying away from us, with one exception, and that's Jeff the Snowman Monson.
Oh, well, he's an anarchist, so I
Yes,
mean, yeah,
exactly.
he ain't gonna listen to anybody, so he's.
Well, to be fair, I think what they figured is he's an anarchist. Let's let him go. By the way, Jeff, show report back what you see up there.
Okay, that could be part of it,
Because
yeah.
that's the way he was acting. It was Jeff is an interesting fellow.
Oh, he is a fascinating Russian plea I yeah, he's a very fascinating listeners, if you've never looked into Jeff Monson, just it's a rabbit hole for sure.
It was making it difficult for us, and it did put a chill in the air for a bunch of fighters. Having said that, we still got most of the people that we wanted, and we had it, you mentioned the E3 event. We had a bunch of UFC guys come by our booth and play the game and hang out with us, and that because they had friends who were fighting in the event, during the show,
Right.
and that was really cool. So. I won't mention any names because they're all retired, obviously. But I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But it was clear that the fraternity of fighters were excited about having another fight game in, and it's nice to make sure that these guys, because most of these folks aren't making tons and tons of money, and we were
Right,
giving them
right.
yet another payday, and they didn't have to get punched in the face.
Right. And if they did, it would only be at like 60 or 70% apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
All right. From a reviews perspective. Oh, actually, before I ask that question, was there any fighters that you didn't get that you looking that you remember? Was there anybody that you guys really wanted? Like you said, you got most of who you wanted. Is there anybody that stands out in your mind that you wanted that you didn't get?
Well, Fitch was one we thought we could get, and we didn't. Shoot, we wanted everybody who was in the UFC.
Right.
Let me think for just a second, because there's trying to think of anybody who said no who wasn't under the UFC banner, who I'm not coming up with much.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, no, it
it's an
was.
on-the-spot question, but yeah, I was just curious if anybody jumped out at you.
No, not really. No, as I
Okay.
said, we were pretty happy with the, we had everybody from like Bob Sapp,
Yes.
to,
I we have a
Fedor.
running we have a running thing on the show. Bob Sapp is, and it's somewhat just for fun, but I can't stand Bob Sapp as a fighter. Like, he
Sure.
just would fold up like a cheap suit.
I
Like, just
know.
you just blow on him, and he would, I don't know how he ever had a winning record in MMA. And he actually did headline one Strikeforce event, which was one of the, I it was probably the worst Strikeforce main event in history. I mean, it was god awful, but yeah. But anyways, yes, Bob Sapp was in the game for those that are playing the drinking game that we do.
Yeah, and our art director was like, I don't know how I'm going to model this guy. He's too
Yeah,
big. He
seriously.
doesn't fit.
God, he's like freaking like what, 6'5", 6'6", like 400 pounds. I mean,
Yeah.
he was of muscle. He was massive. So completely natural, I'm sure, by the way. Completely natural.
But if
Yeah.
I may, one more quick story.
Sure. Yeah,
But
for sure.
yes, not the greatest fighter in the whole world, and you hit him in the face and he's gone. But he called me once from Korea just to chat on the phone. And I'm like, really? All right, I'll chat with you, Bob. That's fine.
I'll talk to Bob, but he might actually been able to reach to the phone and choke you out with his bare hands if he
Yeah.
hadn't. He might be the one guy able to do that. So
Absolutely. But,
yeah.
nice fella. I think we talked twice, and he was in the middle of his K-pop emergence at the time. So, yeah, fun.
Hey, you know what? From a capitalist perspective, I am a huge respecter of Bob Sapp. I mean,
Oh,
just
yeah.
the album, it's, I think it was like It's Sap Time or something like that. And the just he had like a, I guess like a clock, like they merchandised him, and he had like a clock that was like popular. And yeah, I mean, if you're just a, I guess if you're a big, huge black guy, in Japan, that's
Yeah.
like you're like gold, basically. So,
And he was a hustler, so he got his.
I see commercials and guest hosting shows and all kind. He definitely made money off himself. So kudos to him. All right, so bringing things down to a close, but
Sure.
reviews for the game were fairly positive.
Yep.
However, so critical success, but did not sell very well. You mentioned it didn't sell well in Japan, but didn't do super well here in the States as well. It was the only, non-UFC EA video game. So why do you think that was? What are your feelings kind of looking back on it now? Is it something you look back on with pride, or is it, kind of a black mark because it didn't do as well as you all had hoped?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, the thing that we can control is the quality of the game that we put out there, right? And we were very proud of the game, and I think at the time, it got 79 on
Yeah.
Metacritic on
It was
Xbox.
like, it was all the reviews were like 78, 79, 80. They were like right all in there.
And look, 80 is considered, anything above 80 is considered, that's a great job. You've done a great job. The fact that we were 1 point under and it was our first game out, we were really proud of it. It was devastating. I'll be absolutely honest with you. It was devastating to launch, and then our matchmaking was having problems making matches because there weren't that many people on. We sold in the hundreds of thousands after the UFC Undisputed had sold in the millions. And that was, that's there's no it's not fun. But from a pure quality point of view, and from a we were very satisfied with what we did. And honestly, we had plans for the next one that would have been really, really good. We'd already revamped our entire ground game, and th there were prototypes in the works when they finally decided to pull the plug.
Well, that's un it's unfortunate. I remember the game. I feel like I got a copy for free. I may be wrong on that, but either way, I had the game and I enjoyed playing it. And I really liked playing as guys that I got to watch in Strikeforce and Pride and that sort of thing. So it was a fun game from my recollection, for sure.
Well, and we
So.
did something then that nobody had done before. We had live streaming events. This was before Twitch. And we had online fights that you could come watch. And we did that for over, well, I think we did it for a full year. So, once again, a little too early perhaps for the market, but it was a lot of fun to put that stuff on.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, so just a couple, two more questions. Just I know you left EA not super long ago, so just what are you up to now? And is there anything you'd like to mention or promote or anything like that?
Yeah, I don't have a lot to promote. I spent 15 years at EA. I was the game director for Madden Mobile and NBA Live Mobile. And then I moved up to Montreal for a little bit, and I'm in the Seattle area now, and I work for a large company that, puts packages on your doorstep.
Oh, I have a feeling I know which company it is.
Yeah. Actually, I work for the group called Prime Gaming. So if you are a person who's an Amazon Prime member, you can go and get free games from us. We give away games and we give away content for games such as League of Legends and Fortnite and Madden. And it's all free. You just go in there and claim it. And so I'm working with that team to help put more content out there for everybody to have fun with.
Okay, very cool. All right. Well, final question. I guess we'll make it a two-parter, but who is your favorite fighter to deal with during this process, whatever that looks like? And then who is your favorite fighter to play as?
Oh, okay. All right. Good questions to deal with. Well, okay. I don't know if I. So my favorite fighter at the time was Jason Mayhem Miller. And there is a
Oh, man.
YouTube video of him punking me that got 3.4 million views. You can go look it up if you type
Yes,
Jason Mayhem
I'm actually
Miller EA.
I'm literally looking it up right now.
Yeah. And that was a lot of fun. And you can see a picture of me getting punked by Mayhem. And let's see. But so he's crazy. And so that it's got his good sides and the bad side. I would say Kung Lee is one of the nicest fighters that I've
Oh
ever
yeah,
met,
very
and
nice guy.
was also a friend of the team. And so, if I had to put it out there, who was the best to work with? I think I have to put him out there.
Miller's character has a very low fighter skill rating. That's like the
Yes,
little.
there it is.
All right, I'm looking forward to watching this later. Okay.
All right, and then to fight as, let's see, who was my go-to guy back then?
Well, real quick,
Yeah.
while you're thinking about that, I'll name mine.
Okay, go.
I think mine was Shinya Aoki, if I remember correctly, and Kung Lee. So like Shinya, just because obviously the ground game and just that's going to be his thing. So that was fun. But Kung with the kicks, like that's just, I mean, come on. It's like a video game player come to life, or yeah, a video game character come to life. So yeah, those were, if I remember correctly, those were my go-to. And then of course, again, I was managing Lyle, Fear Fancy Pants at the time. So of course, he had to be kind of my sentimental favorite. So yeah.
Absolutely. All right. So first fighter I ever met was Nick the Goat Thompson. And so I would often go back to him because,
That's a deep cut right there.
there
Nick,
you go.
I worked with Nick a little bit too. That's a deep cut. That's a good name.
And then I think if I had to win, and I was in one of those events, I would go with Jacare.
Okay. Good choice. All right, well, Rob, we've actually gone a little longer than we normally do, but I really enjoyed this. This was really a cool conversation, kind of like kind of a deep cut conversation. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Thanks for being on Inside the Hexagon, and especially for sharing all the insight on a fun part of MMA history for sure.
It was my pleasure. I've enjoyed it a great deal too. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, Rob Hyder, for taking the time to join us on Inside the Hexagon. I truly, truly enjoyed that conversation, and I hope that it came through. I had a really great time both reminiscing and learning a lot about the EA Sports MMA video game and just everything, the process behind it, everything that went into it. So many cool stories that Rob shared. So again, I appreciate him taking the time with us. Also appreciate you taking the time to join us. We just celebrated our 1 year anniversary on this podcast, which was just really awesome that we've made it all the way through. Still got months and months to go as we walk through the history of Strikeforce. But so lots of stuff coming up that you can check out. Unfortunately, I was not able to get an interview with Fei Zhao in time to get him on for this week's episode like I'd planned. I'm still hoping to get him on in the future, so stay tuned on that. Coming up next, we are going to be covering Strikeforce Diaz versus Nunes 2. So this is the rematch between the two of them. It is a really, really good fight, so I'm really looking forward to covering that. Sarah Kaufman defends the women's bantamweight title against Marlos Kunin. Josh Thompson is back against Jayzy Cavalcante, and Tyron Woodley makes his main card debut for Strikeforce. So lots of stuff on this card. This one is going to be a fun one as well. Make sure that you're checking us out on Instagram and on Twitter at the Hexagon Pod. And of course, you can reach out to me at fillitinsidethehexagon.com. I would love to hear from you, get your feedback, find out who else you want to hear on the show. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age, because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run, where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.